This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Hello, 90 degrees in the metro area. Blah. Matt Patrick. Looking ahead, I mean, there is a decent chance of some rain on Sunday. But, man, we are so far behind. And after that, it doesn't look like, it looks like, you know, so far so good. It looks pretty good all the way through the at least the beginning of the Friday the 2nd, the Independence Day weekend. We'll have to see. Happy official Juneteenth holiday to you there, Patrick.
Thank you. I appreciate it to you as well.
Happy first ever Juneteenth holiday, Patrick.
Yes, there you go. Indeed.
I get to say that one time. There you go. Congratulations. I'm glad we're recognizing it. And once again, I had a great, there was a great piece I had yesterday on from PBS that talked about the real history and the fact that how many slave owners desperately tried to hide that the slaves were freed from their slaves for years after the Civil War. It was amazing that that travesty is not more known. But now we can learn these things. And I think, you know, learning history is a good thing. Learning history is a good thing. So go check that out. The links for all that, by the way, still up on the social media sites. On Twitter, at Matt McNeil Show. On Facebook, The Progressive Citizen X, Matt McNeil Show. And Progressive Citizen X is where I'm going to start today. Now, it's the blog. If you haven't read the blog, it's a hoot. Hasn't been a lot of stuff there lately because, you know, me in the hospital, what are you going to do? But, you know, Patrick, there are two kinds of radio broadcasters. You know, the kind of radio broadcaster where, you know, you come in here, and I'm not talking about journalists. I'm talking about, you know, people that talk about things they're passionate about, the people that they are. You know, and then there's the people that come on in, and even though that they're things they want to talk about, it's like, we've got Chef Claude coming in here to talk about lemon bars. You know, that sort of thing. I'm not the lemon bar guy, although I love a good lemon bar. Oh, good lemon bars are tasty. But I'm the kind of guy that wears what is frustrating me on my sleeve. And I'm beyond livid today. I imagine a lot of you know why. Let's get into it, shall we? The latest post on Progressive Citizen X, the blog piece, is called Dear U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. There you go. Let's start there. Dear U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Let me begin by saying, how dare you? Seriously, as your pews empty, as your congregations shrink, you once again take a religion that's supposed to be based on peace, love, welcoming, and understanding, and turn it into a weapon of hate to help your personal political motivations over the teachings of Jesus and God. You are heretics, you are fools, and you are wrong. At this point, I want to say, Patrick, what do you think? Should I do lemon bars? You know, should I continue at this point? I can go back to lemon bars. No, don't worry. Patrick, do yourself a favor. Stay out of this one, or I'll do this on my own, okay? If you're wondering what this is all about, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, lured and seduced by political power waved at them from Republican politicians who want to turn Catholicism in the United States into a conservative political litmus test, have decided to personally attack Joe Biden by trying to write rules to prevent the president from receiving communion in church. Joe Biden, by the way, is a devout Catholic. He attends church regularly, more since any president since Jimmy Carter. But that's moot. The bishops are out to persecute him. We see right through these bishops of hate at their true motivation of what they are doing. It is about personal political power for them. Now, my usual religious disclaimer, okay? I put this out every time I talk about religion. I'm Catholic. You do or don't do whatever it is you do or don't want to do, okay? I'm not here to change anyone's mind. You do what you want to do. Don't want to do anything? More power to you. That's life. My family is Catholic. My wife and I married in the church, going through the Catholic training we had to do. And we actually renewed our vows there as well. My three kids were all baptized in the church. We have had their first communion in the church. The two of the three have actually been confirmed. We've gone through Sunday school and church camps. We're regular attendees of service. We go at least 40 times a week, a year, usually pre-pandemic, obviously. We attend a more liberal church. I love it. I've been to fire and brimstone churches. And there was a guy, Father Howard, I was at down in Iowa. He was good. There are times I actually really enjoyed him. But I'm not a big fan of leaving a church service with a list of people I'm supposed to hate in the name of Jesus. I'm just not a big fan of that. So I'm not a big fan of the fire and brimstone. I've served on church committees, and I have volunteered. Also, for the record, and before, let me read this whole next paragraph before anyone gets upset. Okay, let me read the whole thing. For the record, I'm against abortion. Now, that's a personal decision and one every individual should make for themselves. My faith tells me we are all judged by our own actions on this planet, so I can't just point to someone else and say, they told me to do that. You make your own decision. That's how you live a happy life. You can go through life happy with the decision that you have made. Okay. I wrote about my personal feelings. And by the way, anyone saying, where did this come from? He's just bringing this up to try to make a political point right now. Actually, no, funny story. I wrote the blog piece called Abortion 5 years ago. It's on Progressive Citizen X. And I will put a link up for it a little bit later as well about that. All right. All right. It's been a rough few decades for the Catholic Church. Let's just be honest. The child sex abuse scandal, which reached across the globe, was deplorable, evil, unacceptable, and heartbreaking. I saw church attendance cut in half. No one can blame the parishioners who left. Slowly, a few came back, but the numbers still have not recovered from that disgrace, and frankly, nor should they. Nor should they. If you're wanting to praise the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops for attacking Joe Biden, you're also praising some of the many same people who were in leadership positions within the church when the child sex scandal occurred, and some of them likely knew. Many leaders within the church enabled the abusers for decades. You want to make these people heroes? That's on you. I put the full record on display. What the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is saying is that since Catholic teachings state abortion is wrong, that Joe Biden, as a Catholic president, must be the most anti-abortion president ever. If he doesn't force his Catholic views on all people, including all non-Catholics and non-Christians, then he's enabling abortion and should not receive the communion. That's their big argument right there. All right? That's their big thing that they put forward. That it's not enough for him to personally be against it. It's not enough for him to go to church. It's not enough to be a devout Catholic. That the fact is that he does not weaponize the office of presidency against abortion rights, that somehow he has failed as a Catholic. Okay? That's what their argument is, and henceforth is not worthy of communion. That's what their argument is. Isn't that rich? Anti-abortion policy is Catholic teaching, and depending on the zealot's interpretation, even goes as far as to say what a blessing babies conceived from rape and incest are. They are. The reality is the Bible is a mixed bag when it comes to abortion. Sure, there's a lot of passages that back up life undeniably. But there are passages which seem to go the other way, too. And a quick side note here, there are a lot of Catholic leaders who will say, you need to follow the passage verbatim when the passage backs up the point of view. But when the passage doesn't, the next line is, well, let me tell you what they meant. FYI. Go to Numbers 5, 11 through 31, outlines a conversation between the Lord and Moses, which basically gives how-to instructions on having an abortion. Exodus 21, 22, 23 originally only referred to the health of the pregnant woman, not the baby fetus at all. That's actually well known. It's only been reinterpreted in recent years by political opportunists who want to basically turn the Catholic Church into a tool of the Republican Party. And Psalm 137, 9, that's pretty straightforward as well. By the way, the Bible is also chock full of stories where pregnant women, babies, and kids are violently killed. When you think about Noah, you always think about a boat full of animals, not all the pregnant women, fetuses, babies, and kids God killed with the flood. He had to. There wasn't like a raft of babies behind the boat, was there? Nope. Wiped them all out. God did that. And there's also one other slight problem with anti-abortion teachings within the church. Jesus never once condemned abortion. Not once. Not once. He didn't. He praised life, but he never once condemned abortion. I know Catholic bishops will say the entire Bible and biblical teachings are sacred, well, the ones the churches allow us to be taught. But the reality is, what makes Christians and Catholics is the story of Jesus, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They tell the story of Jesus from birth to resurrection. And at no point in the four Gospels does Jesus ever state, abortion is wrong, never do it. It's not like abortion wasn't practiced back then. It was. It's not like Jesus doesn't give a lot of other direct commands. He does. He never condemned it. That's a fact. The USCCB has decided to boil the Catholic faith down to one sin and use that as a condemnation stick. Once again, my church is telling me who to hate, who to shun, who to dismiss, who to marginalize, who to segregate, who to demonize, and by proxy, who to vote for in political elections. No, thank you. And let's just cut through the veil of your righteousness here, USCCB. You've snuggled up with the most loathsome of people, including Trump, a man who is straight out of biblical villainy. When anyone in the Catholic Church embraces a far-right conservative politician, they are gleefully snuggling up to people who've ripped the Gospel of Matthew from their Bible. Matthew 25, 35 to 45. If I may, once again, not proselytizing. This is not about converting anyone. This is their standard. I am throwing this back in their face. Matthew 25, 35 to 45. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him saying, Lord, when did I see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you a drink? And when did you see a stranger and welcome you or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer him, truly I say to you, you do it to one of the least of my brothers, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you cursed in the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me. Naked, you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me. Then they also will answer saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick in person and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them saying, truly I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did it not do it for me. Basically, it's a direct command from Jesus that you got to take care of the hungry, the thirsty, Flint, Michigan. You remember that? Yeah. Got to clothe the naked, take care of the sick, take care of the people in prison, and welcome in strangers from strange mans. Funny story. You should read it. It's a hoot. The Bible's got tons of stories. That's out of Matthew. And that sentiment is repeated over and over. I mean, it clearly is one of the tentpole teachings of Jesus. Once again, what makes Christians and Catholics, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Matthew clearly says what you're supposed to do. Jesus said to do this, and it is repeated throughout the Bible, and these Catholic bishops just do not care. They love people that hate Matthew. You tell me what's a bigger sin, USCCB, realizing your political office goes beyond your own personal religious beliefs and allowing individuals to make their own choices in life, or is it a group of self-serving bishops who have allowed major teaching of Jesus himself to be thrown out, eagerly bastardizing their own faith because they want to be welcomed into the far-right political club for personal power? You tell me what's the bigger sin there, bishops. Please. When was the last time any of these bishops said, if a politician doesn't do everything within their own power to feed the hungry, they cannot receive communion? Jesus told us to do so directly. When was the last time you said, if a politician doesn't do everything within their power to give water to the thirsty, they cannot receive communion? Remember Flint? You guys completely forget about that one, didn't you? Jesus told us to do that directly. When was the last time you said, if a politician doesn't do everything with their own power to clothe the needy, they cannot receive communion? Jesus told us to do so directly. When was the last time you said if a politician doesn't do everything in their power to help the sick or to visit prisoners, they cannot receive communion? Jesus told us to do that directly. And if I may, when was the last time you heretics said if a politician doesn't do everything within their power to welcome in strangers from strange lands, they cannot receive communion? Jesus told us to do so directly. USCCB, you don't dare call anyone else a cafeteria or a Catholic when you are the ones, as supposed leaders of the church, who pick and choose which teachings of Jesus to ignore and downplay. You're the ones with the compromised morality. And let's also admit the truth. Joe Biden could cave to every one of your demands, and you still wouldn't embrace him. You'd find some other made-up outrage to lean on because this has nothing to do with religion, only politics and the political power you individually crave. With all apologies to the more reasonable and educated leaders within the Catholic Church who I've enjoyed immensely, I've gotten guidance from, including Pope Francis, I can no longer take this constant betrayal. Consider this my official resignation from the Catholic Church. I'm taking my monthly donation too. I will not be part of this organization if this is what evil people are determined to turn it into. There are too many other churches who are not looking to weaponize Jesus. And what should scare the USCCB is this reality. I'm not the only person saying this today. I guarantee the Catholic Church just lost a lot of parishioners. And in reality, it's not like your actions are going to even register a blip of new attendance to your masses of persecution. You think a bunch of evangelicals are going to say, oh, I'm going to become Catholic now? Nope. You didn't do anything for your church outside of basically divide it. You do not care, though. This was never about anything. This is never about the betterment of the church, USCCB. This was only about you. Goodbye. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I'm taking a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. How about those lemon bars? You know, I want to make sure people understand something. I want to be a good Catholic. I do. And this is my, this is once again, religious disclaimer. You do or don't do whatever it is you do or don't want to do. I'm Catholic. I like the faith. I like the holidays. I like the church. I love fish fries. I do. I really do. But this is, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of this. I am tired of, and what this is just people within the church who are addicted to political power. And they want that political power. And they will destroy the Catholic Church as long as they feel as if they personally gain. And that's all this is. It's all this. And the Catholic bishops are all, oh, well, this has nothing to do with the elections. Yeah, it does. Oh, how stupid do you think we are, bishops? Of course it does. Of course it does. And I don't go to church for politics in the same sense as I don't go to politics for religion. I don't. Those are two separate things. And you guys just want to sit there and because you are fools who have been seduced by the idea that somehow this gives you a chance at the brass ring. What are you trying to do? Break the Catholic Church into two to start your own little Vatican USA? Is that what this is all about? I know. The bishops are going to look at me like, you uppity little parishioner, what do you know? I don't know. I've just followed the teachings of the church, and I try to be a good Catholic. But if I, not a lifetime theologian, not a seasoned priest or bishop or a leader within the church, can look at this and say, what a joke. What are you doing? That should tell you something. And like I said, I like religion. I do. It's personal. This is just me. You do what you want to do, okay? I like it. I've enjoyed it. I've had some phenomenal priests. Father Bill has been wonderful. I loved him. Father Patrick, I've had wonderful priests that I've learned a lot from. Father Herb, gosh, the history that guy knew. The knowledge of the history behind all the passages. Oh, my goodness. He was just so wonderful to hear him talk about where the passages come from, the times it was written, and how it was impacted down there, and the real radicalness of some of the things that were said back then. I mean, really good stuff. But here come this U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops who feel if it's their job to basically persecute under this false veil of righteousness. No, it's not. It's your addiction to power. It's your addiction to power. You're going to be welcomed in the clubs. You're going to go play some golf. You can get those Catholics in line, get them voting for Trump or Trump. We'll make sure we put a few dollars in that collection plate. Have you seen how much the evangelicals really don't like the Catholics? I have. Not exactly snuggle buddies. And once again, what's your end game here? Do you think, a bunch of the Baptists are just going to say, oh, wow, look what the Catholics are doing. They're persecuting Biden. Well, we're going to give up our Baptist faith and we're going to run over and convert to be Catholics. No. Do you think people, we've talked about for the first time ever, fewer than half the people in this country are associated with a church. And it keeps going down. You think this is going to turn that around? Hey, I know we've been starting to push people out the door by telling them who to hate, but let us tell you who you really need to hate now. Most of these Trump supporters who claim to be godly people, they don't go. They watch football pregame on Sunday. They're not Catholic. The church is something they occasionally grab onto because it thinks it gives their argument provenance. That's all it is. And then you got people like myself, a liberal, a progressive, who happens to be trying to be a good Catholic, who likes going to church, who likes to be there, who has just been pushed out of the church by the bishops who say, well, unless you hate Joe Biden. Oh, we're not saying hate Joe Biden. Yes, you are. You're going out of your way to do this. Yes, you are. I hope Francis comes back and throws you all out. I'm serious. I hope Pope Francis comes out and said, I wanted all your resignations. I hope he does. Because the damage you have done to your church today is insurmountable. And I know, you'll wrap yourself in the most extremist or far-right political ideologies saying, we're good. No, you're not. Because this is not about the church. It's about you and your political power. And because of that, that's why I'm done. I tried. I tried so hard to find a reason to quit during the child abuse scandal. I tried. And I said, we can make this better. And this is how you reward us for sticking around. This is how you reward us by saying, well, if God forbid you like Joe Biden, which I do, then I'm not welcome in the church because, he's a sinner. He's not doing enough. He's not going to get communion. While you eagerly embrace people who represent everything the Bible and the church is supposed to be for, or represent everything against what the Bible and the church is supposed to be for. It's a disgrace. It's just a disgrace. So, yeah, now the pandemic restrictions, I guess you've opened up my Sunday until I find a new church and a new denomination, one that's not going to tell me how my political vote's supposed to go. Nice going, fools. Nice going. 952-946-6205. I'm going to move completely away from this. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to take any calls. I'm moving on. I got too many other things to get to. Busy 5 o'clock hour as well. It's the Matt McNeil Show coming up right here on AM 950. By the way, I will post that up on Progressive Citizen. It's already up on ProgressiveCitizenX.com on Blogspot. 952-946-6205. Let's get into the, what basically would be a law roundup here. Let's see a truck driver who drove in the massive protest on Interstate 35W bridge last summer in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder. We'll see the two criminal charges against him drop if he remains law-abiding for the next year. Wow. Bogdan Verchirko, 36, entered what is called a continuance without prosecution agreement with Hennepin County prosecutors before District Judge William Koch on Friday. for Chirico appeared to be via an online court session that lasted about 20 minutes. The arraignment is not a plea bargain. He didn't speak beyond saying yes, sir, to the judge's questions about the process. He wore a suit coat. I don't know why that's in there. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman didn't charge Verchirko for the incident until last October, months after it transpired, in charging him with threats of violence, a felony, and criminal vehicular operation, a gross misdemeanor. The prosecution said he had admitted to investigators that he was kind of in a hurry and that the investigation found he sought to scare protesters out of his path. The incident was specifically unsettling because it came amid days and nights of upheaval in the Twin Cities following George Floyd's murder by former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Like Floyd's killing, the incident on the bridge was captured on surveillance cameras as well. Bennett Hartz of Minneapolis, a protester on the bridge that day, talked about the ongoing trauma he experiences from the event, saying he still has nightmares and jumps out of his skin when he hears fireworks or a car backfire. He said it's a miracle that no one was killed that day. It is a miracle. The judge acknowledged that, saying, I don't think anybody looking at that would have taken any bet that no one would have been seriously injured. Well, then why'd you let him go? At the time he was charged, attorney Mark Solheim said the driver was faced with a terrifying situation and did what he could to avoid injuring anyone. Yeah, he ran through a roadblock. Returning from fuel delivery in South Minneapolis gas station, he got on the interstate via Hennepin-Lindale. The criminal complaint said at least one protester suffered abrasions as he jumped out of the trunk's path. None of the protesters who attacked the injured driver were charged, though. He got a few cuts to his face. Well, I'll tell you what, once again, he lives out of the metro area, you know, whiter guy. Guess what? Yeah, that's what happens. So I don't agree with that. He should be facing some charges. But if do me this favor, if he steps one inch out of line, can you block him back up? A man with a lengthy criminal record that includes multiple driving offenses is now charged with hitting and killing that teen skateboarder in Minneapolis. The criminal complaint details the charges against 34-year-old Bobby Frank Brookins, who is charged with two counts of criminal vehicular homicide. Each count involves the death of a 16-year-old. Daishan Chu comes with a maximum recommended sentence of 15 years. Minneapolis police was dispatched to the intersection of 51st Avenue North and Fremont North on the night of June 15th, and reports of a fatal crash. Officers found a teenager, later identified as Chu, laying on the ground with several people performing CPR. First responders took Chu to the hospital, where he's pronounced dead. Investigators at the scene noticed several parked vehicles with significant damage and a Chevy Traverse SUV in the front lawn of a residence. Witnesses told police the man suspected of hitting him was driving northbound on Fremont at a high rate of speed, failed to stop at a stop sign. He was crossing the intersection and he was struck. The driver, identified by Brookings, continued north on Fremont, hit several cars, losing wheel in the process. And then he noted that the damage on the hull of the windshield. He was apprehended at the scene. Officers say he was visibly intoxicated, smelled of alcohol, and he was admitted driving the vehicle and hitting the teen. So, once again, drinking and driving. And that's the consequences of that. I got to do an update on this one. Minneapolis police are investigating what they believe is a homicide after the human remains were found in two locations in the northeast side of the city. Speaking at a news conference on Thursday night, Minneapolis police, John Elder, said detectives believe the victim is a white male, possibly in his 30s. Said people need to stay vigilant as police have not found. They say they haven't found them all. So. He said detectives and forensic teams are analyzing the evidence. Well, can I ask you this? Can you send them out to scour the city a little bit? These cases take a toll. These cases are incredibly difficult. I have zero. Okay. Criticism, the justifiable criticism of police activities to any officer who is having to respond to something this gruesome. Anyone, paramedic, ambulance, officer, detective, prosecutor, I imagine you're on the scene too. Please make sure, seriously, go see some counseling if you need it. I mean, these are tough things. These are the things that cause people not to be able to sleep for weeks and stuff. So anyone that's responding to this, please, if you do, talk to someone, because this is just, these are hard cases, but this is wild. Case takes toll. They're difficult. On Thursday morning, passersby called police about 9:30 a.m. to report possible body parts near 3rd Avenue Northeast and Main Street Northeast. Officers arrived, located the items. They didn't, in fact, appear to be human body parts. When police were processing that scene, they received a report of additional human remains. They found in the area 3rd and University, about 2 blocks away. Officers went to scene as well. Cadaver dogs responded to the area, but not finding remains. Officers are working with a medical examiner in the crime lab to get these items retrieved, get them down to the medical experts where they'll work with the homicide to identify the person, hopefully. They're trying to go through missing persons reports and see if they can find anything, any kind of information there. So, yeah, that's. You know, it's... what is wrong with some people? What is going on there? And that's some scary stuff. And we've had, let's just face it. Okay, we have the drunk driver Brookins killing the skateboarder. You have the drunk driver possibly with other motivations. He was accelerating. The idea that the police are somewhat accepting the idea that, you know, he was going to try to evil Knievel it over the protesters in Uptown. I don't know, but kills a protester there. You have the case in Brooklyn Park of a man that should have never been released from a comprehensive treatment program, killing someone. Now this. It's tough days. Tough days indeed. 952-946-6205. I want to get one other note, not a crime report, although knowing how Republicans work with the tax code, I guess we could maybe loop it on in there. I do want to say that Brianna Beerspot came up with a story right as I was getting ready to leave here about there is an agreement on the tax bill. Apparently, Minnesota's divided legislature have agreed to provide nearly $1 billion in tax relief over the next 4 years, focusing on businesses that receive federal payroll loans and workers who collected unemployment checks during the COVID-19 pandemic. The final agreement extends tax credits to preserving historic buildings and film production in Minnesota while pumping $20 million into local governments to help student homelessness in communities across the state. All right. Good across there. It's not nothing. You had the budget surplus, so I'm not exactly too upset by any of this so far. Notably, the package includes no new tax increases. This is a great bill. We started from very, very different places, says Senate Tax Chair Carla Nelson of Rochester. Minnesotans are still recovering from the economic fallout of the pandemic and would have been really disastrous to tax them. Governor Walz and top legislative leaders had reached a broad deal on the tax bill on the last day of the regular session on May 17th. The negotiators have spent weeks behind the scenes working out the details. It is one of the more complicated. You know why you don't hear as many things about the tax bill is because there is a lot of things they got to go over. So if they start getting into the Bill Ingebrigtsen, we're going to clean cars things, they're not going to get it done. So that's one kind of saving grace of the tax bill, is because it is so complicated and so thick, it kind of prevents the clowns from taking over. And by the way, I don't agree with Carla Nelson. She seems to be one of the more practical Republicans. I don't agree with her. I'm not about to vote for her or anything like that. But notice they put the people there that are like, okay, give me the smart people in the Republican Party. We'll put them on this committee. We'll put the rest of the – we'll put the other guys on these other committees. So it is a more – there is a nuance to it because there is a lot of things they got to go over. Both sides came together around the relief of people hitting hardest in the pandemic, position bolstered by projected budget surplus and billions flowing in from the federal government. And this is one of the reasons why Governor Walz had the powers. With the emergency powers he had, they had to as well. And we talked about this. The Republicans had to come to a deal on the tax bill because of the fact that the governor could have gone around them. So there was a lot of incentive. And give Walz credit. He did give them a lot of business stuff they wanted to put in there. So that's, you know, a business deal. So, you know, it's not like they didn't get anything out of it. I mean, it seems like a fairly amicable sausage-making bill. You know how that works. 85% of the bill deals with COVID-19 relief and recovery, said Paul Marquardt, DFLer from Dilworth, who chairs the House Tax Committee. A huge benefit will provide immediate relief assistance for tax cuts for a lot of folks. The Minnesota Department of Revenue estimates 560,000 Minnesotans who received federal COVID aid over the last year will get a tax relief under the bill. The package conforms a state and federal tax code for the rest of the or it's code for the tens of thousands of state businesses that receive forgivable payable protection program loans that were used to help cover employee salaries, even as some businesses were shuttered due to the pandemic. As long as that money wasn't being used for cars, because we're seeing that. We're seeing people that took advantage of this situation and spent the money on their own personal stuff. You make sure they're not getting tax breaks after they abuse the system. Please, thank you very much. Minnesota's new tax law had treated those forgiven loans as taxable income, even though Congress moved late last year to make the assistance tax-free on the federal level. The bill excludes from income up to $10,200 in employment insurance compensation. Lawmakers excludes, rather, from income up to $10,000. So I'm going to guess the lowest bracket is not going to get taxed at all. That's how I'm taking that. Lawmakers also aligned the tax code with the federal government in other areas, including home short sales and small business loans. Department of Revenue Commissioner Robert Dottie says the majority of those refunds will be automatic and manually done by the agency, but some filers may have to fill out more paperwork, obviously, depending on the situation. There's disagreement about when that the work can start, though, when they came to amending if they had to fix things. Nelson said the PPP and unemployment provisions have been broadly agreed to for more than a month. Dottie said they can't start much of that work until the bill is passed and signed by the governor, which is the thing. I mean, the state government can't actually start working on a deal until they've got a law or a bill passed. So you got to pass the bill. You can't expect them to do these things beforehand. And you can't expect them to expect to do them. They can't do that because then things fall apart and then all of a sudden they're culpable. Legislators are facing a July 1st deadline in regards to passing the budget bill and state risk government shutdown. Speaker Hortman said the tax bill will likely be the last to be voted on in the chamber as leverage to make sure other work is completed. Good for you, Speaker Hortman. Other provisions tucked in the bill, tax bill are appealing on both sides. It extends tax credit for angel investors and those who restore and rehabilitate historic properties and buildings. It provides a tax credit to the film production in the state, which I know a lot of people wanted to see that continue because of doubt, basically, stopping the Minnesota, you know, the Hollywood bills that were here and the filming credits that basically a lot of those had moved out, but now they can come back. There's an affordable housing tax credit that focuses on workforce housing, single housing family homes, and small towns. The bill extends the working family tax credit to 19 and 20 year olds. Small towns is a big gift to the outstate Republicans, I guess. There are things that are going to spark economic development in our states, said Nelson. The bill also provides counties with aid to help prevent students from winding up on the streets, which can keep them in the classroom. These are folks that in kind of issues that we don't talk about normally in tax committee, people with no income or no home, said Marquardt. What this bill provides is real solutions for a huge problem. So, and this is, like I said, why do you have someone like Carla Nelson in there who, once again, don't necessarily agree with her, but she understands this is that like the homeless stuff. Can you imagine what Ingebrigtsen or Kiffmeyer or Tori Westrom would be like if you said, we're going to get a tax credit and we're going to help the homeless students on the streets? No, I'm going to Alaska. That's it. So that's why you have to have adults in the room. One final note I do want to make sure I mention about what's going on. Yesterday, there was this massive filibuster by the House Republicans. You do realize, I know the House Democrats, there's a lot of exasperated eye rolls in the House Democrats. You understand what's going on. Do you remember the first day of the special session and a bunch of the clown car far righters showed up saying, you're all traitors if you don't drag walls out of the governor's mansion now. That's who they were. They showed up. And they were going after guys like Osmek, and they're going after guys like Kiffmeyer, and they're going after Doubt, and they're going after Gazelka. And those guys were just sitting like, what did we do? This whole thing, this filibuster yesterday, all them filibustering all these bills, just get some coffee, stagger the Democratic leadership so that people are up 24-7, 365 over the next few days, and let these clown cars just go talk and talk and talk, because that's all it is. They're trying to show these people, see, we're trying to stop things. We're not going to let stuff pass. It's all a dog and pony show. At the end of the day, the House Republicans are not going to get in the way of these bills, especially like the budget bill, especially if that's the last bill that gets passed. They're not going to get in the way of these bills. And so they're going to sit there and they're going to bloviate and they're going to say, see, I'm trying to drag Governor Walz out of the governor's mansion by filibustering. Well, let them. That's their right. Just grab a cup of coffee, put on your headphones, maybe some noise canceling, if I may make the suggestion, there, Democrats, and let them go. Let them go. And then, you know, maybe like 4 days before everything's about to go, tick-tock goes the clock here. You want to shut down the government, we'll shut it down. And then they'll stop and say, see, we made noise. Oh, God, I'm glad Speaker Hortman. I'm glad Ryan Winkler, Representative Winkler is there as well. It's nice to have adults in charge of the House again. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. I've got a theory about where all the workers that used to work in restaurants have gone, and I think I've figured it out. I'll talk about that when I return. Cooligan, when we come back in the 5 o'clock hour as well, it's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. So yesterday we were talking about, what was the story? About Lord Fletcher's. So I was bringmethenews.com. They had a story there. We're not going to be having our Sunday brunch after Father's Day. It's too difficult to get staff out here. And we brought up the point. Now, first of all, if you have not been to Lord Fletcher's, it's one of those places where people like to get up in the morning and they dress up and they get on their boat and they go cruising around and make Minnetonka and they, oh, let's go stop over there and we'll have breakfast over at Lord Fletcher's. You know, kind of one of those places. It's not bad food. I've been there. I've been there a few times, actually. It's okay. It's worth a trip. But we brought up a few other things. It's okay, you're out in a fairly wealthy community. What's your employment draw anyway? What are you paying? Because, I mean, if I've got, you know, Johnny Little Silver Spoon here, you want to go on out there and work at what? A dish line? What are they paying? $11? Never. I'll have you watched the doc. That sort of thing. So I don't know what you're – I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, there are people – obviously, you know, a lot of communities have to work to try to get low-income housing so they can have people that are there that can take some of the support jobs that they need. But, I mean, how much of your draw is your area? Is there any mass transit that goes out there on Sunday morning that can bring workers out to you? I doubt it. That's a pretty fringe route. If it is, once again, it comes down to what are you paying? But there was something that last night a friend of mine brought up, and I said, oh, my gosh, I think she's right. So one of my daughter's friends came over and had dinner with us, and we asked, what are you doing? And she goes, oh, well, I'm cooking and delivering food at a senior center. So, well, that's great. She goes, it pays really well. Does it? Well, and yeah, you know, they talk about safety protocols. Obviously, and they're in full gear. You know, they the full PPE, you know, the masks and shields. And but it's the same exact job that you had at a restaurant. Only you're doing it in a much more controlled environment, a much healthier environment. It's not nearly as beer sticky, cocktail sticky. You're dealing with, you know, generally elderly patients who are fairly amicable, and it's pays really well. I mean, these jobs, some of these jobs are high teens, even into the low 20s, you're getting paid for a high school kid? You're kidding me. No, that makes a lot of sense. And that was the one, and I started thinking about how many friends I have who have kids who are now cooking and delivering food, because they can't really do the room stuff, anything medical. But they're out there. They'll go to like a senior center or a nursing home or a care facility, and they'll go in the morning, help make all the food and the breakfast, put it on the trays, put the trays there, take it to the individual room, say a quick hello, drop the food off, go back, pick up the tray, take it back, clean it up, go home. 3 hours of work, you made $60. You're kidding me. In a heartbeat, in a freaking heartbeat. And when you compare that to, well, you'll make $30, you got to work 6 hours longer than you wanted to, so you got to work all day Sunday, and you'll make $30, and you might get some tips, Is this really a choice? I counted, of my friends, at least 5 kids I know who are working at that exactly, going to a senior center, nursing home, critical care facility. They cook the food, they plate the food, they deliver the food, they pick up the tray, they do the dishes, and they head home. Maybe the problem you're having is a similar industry, because let's face it, restaurants and these care facilities are not the same business, for goodness sakes. But maybe a similar industry who said, okay, well, we need workers, went out and said, well, Bob's Bucket of Chicken over there is not paying very well. They've got 6 employees. If we can go get 4 of them to come over here, we'll pay them basically 50% more than they're getting paid right now. They'll be much healthier. We should mention part of that story yesterday. One of the most stark elements of the restaurant worker story is by far the most affected group of workers in America to COVID. The people that took the most deaths and got the most illnesses were not meat processing workers, were line workers in restaurants, were cooks. I didn't realize that. That's shocking. So they can say, you know what? You can either go there and get sick as a dog, shoveling out wings and French fries for drunks on a Saturday afternoon, or you can come on over. You come work in the morning for 3 hours. You come work in the afternoon for 4 hours, and you get a visit with the elderly. You get to go do this food, relatively safe, pretty simple. You do this, plate it, give it to them, do the best you can. And say you work, say it's close to 20. Think about that. Say if it's close to $20 an hour and you're working 7 hours a day, a kid making 140 bucks on a weekend. Is this really a question? I actually think this is actually where most of these workers have gone. And that's why these guys are like, why doesn't anyone want to come back? And before, once again, we also brought up the story yesterday, Minnesota's unemployment rate went down. So workers are going back. So if they're not going to the restaurants, where are they going? They're getting poached by these other businesses. I guarantee it. The more I think about it, the more it's there, because I know a lot of people that are getting jobs there in these nursing homes and senior centers, and they're making coin. They're making coin. Correction! Peter Callahan's joining us from MinnPost. Peter Callahan joining us today. Cooligans on Tuesdays. Peter Callahan, MinnPost, with Brett Johnson. We'll bring Brett on into the studio next hour right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. Brett Johnson, kind enough to join us on a Friday. Also, Patrick, I want to bring Patrick on in here, too, because we were talking a little bit in the break, because I really do think this, and I don't know if you heard this, but Brett, that when these restaurants talk about where their workers went, I think a lot of them went to the senior centers, nursing homes, care facilities, because I know a lot of people that are over there. They get paid a lot better. It's a lot safer, healthier environment. It's a much easier environment. And that might be part of the reason. Of course, we talk about wages. There's other things involved. It's not the extra unemployment, because our unemployment rate in Minnesota has actually gone down. And Patrick, during the break, brought up a very good point. Patrick, you're talking about the way that management treats workers a lot of times, something that was echoed by listeners yesterday.
Yep, exactly. I used to work in a restaurant before this job, and you go in, you work an 8-hour shift. It's not easy. You deal with customers who don't like you, management who doesn't like you, and you were talking about the I said I can only work, X, Y, and Z days. And they're like, well, we want you to work A, B, and C days. And they schedule you for that. And when you say I can't work A, B, and C days, they kind of get – they don't like that, even though you told them I can't do that.
And not only did you tell them, but I guarantee you they said, oh, that's no problem. We'll work around your schedule. That'll be easy. And then the first schedule is, I told you I can't work Wednesday. Well, if you're not here, you don't work here. Well, there you go. I had there was a radio station. I'm not going to say where. It was a radio station I was working at, and it was going to be a long drive for me to go. This is when I first moved back to town. They needed someone to do some part-time weekend stuff. So I said, sure, I can drive on out, but I need some kind of compensation for gas, because it was an hour-plus drive out of town. And they said, sure, well, you can go down to Squiggy's Gas, and we'll get you a Squiggy's Gas coupon. Great. And I wrote in my notes, Squiggy's Gas. Now, I don't know where Squiggy's is, and that wasn't the name of the place, but I don't know where Squiggy's Gas is. So the first time I said, hey, I need to get one of those gas coupons so I can drive. He goes, why would you ever think I would ever give you one of those? I said, well, then why would I write Squiggy's gas coupons on my notes when you hired me? Because was that just a lucky guess by me? Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're trying to say? And of course, I got him flummoxed on that one. And I said, well, thanks. And I walked away. But they do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when you're talking about the service industry and when these guys say, nobody wants to work today. How about you look in the mirror sometimes?
Exactly. Are you paying them well? Some of those people, like, and think about the job. You go in, like I said, you're making food for a care facility, fairly easy recipes, nothing too heavy duty, maybe some low salt options, whatever, some dietary issues. You make the food, you plate it, take them on in there. You're $17, $18, $20, $22 an hour. If you're a high school kid, that's gold, man. Especially even if it's a little bit of off hours, like 6 a.m. until like 9 a.m. I'd get up and go get that because it's $60 for 3 hours.
High school or college, man, I would have been all over that. Oh. Beats Walgreens where I worked back in those days.
And wouldn't it be great? You walk in, it's like, oh, there's that lovely Brett. Oh, Brett, it's good to – did you bring me the mashed potatoes today? I like those. Tell me more about when you were growing up. I had a boy like you one day. I would do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, instead of someone – complaining, why isn't this on sale? This was supposed to be buy one, get one free. I have a manufacturer's coupon, all that stuff.
It's supposed to Brett out there. Hey, Brett, shake your money maker, man. Where's my next pitcher of beer, man? Get that caboose moving. Sorry, sir. I think the option is there. So one other story to get to before we get to our friend Peter Callahan at MinnPost, who's kind enough to join us today. A neighbor is accused of setting fire to a 20-foot-tall Frankenstein's monster statue in Janesville, Minnesota. Didn't think I'd be reading this one today. Luke Dwayne Olson, 35, of Janesville, is charged with second-degree arson, first-degree property damage, both felonies, in connection to the June 12th incident. This actually is sad because there is some history to this. Olson is accused of starting the fiberglass statue that stands near the intersection of West Mill Street and South Main Street in Janesville on fire at 2 a.m. that day. I wonder if alcohol was involved.
No.
Nah, fire at 2 a.m.? What could have happened? The fire destroyed the entire structure, leaving only the metal frame standing at the Janesville car wash. Surveillance camera from the car wash showed a man, later identified as Olson, between some of the cars in the salvage area at the Janesville Service Center with a blanket over his head and a gas can in his hand. He milled about around the cars for a short time before heading toward the car wash. The criminal complaint says, Olson then walked towards the Frankenstein's monster statue, attempted to light it on fire, then walked away, charges state. Then about 4 minutes later, he was spotted again on surveillance video with a blue tarp over his head, carrying a gas can and some type of bottle. He walked toward the statue, started the base of it on fire, then left, the complaint says. After watching the video, police suspected Olson that they later found a leather wallet on the ground. He left his wallet in the salvage area to contain his driver's license. Police also found the blue tarp matching the one from the video in Olson's yard, about 0.1 miles away from the statue. Olson denied being involved in the fire and was arrested. The complaint does not detail any of the reasons why Olson lit the statue on fire. Police searched his home, finding a blanket similar to the one in the video, several gas cans and shoes that matched the ones of the suspect, which smelled of gasoline. How did he not set himself on fire? That would have been the greatest. Frankenstein goes up and there's a guy running on fire with looking for his wallet. Wow. Investigators spoke to the owner of the statue, Mark Bornke, and estimated the cost would be $14,000 to replace it. Bornke told Fox 9 he wants to get Frankenstein's monster rebuilt, but has to find the artist's son, who's the only one with the original design. He said there had been discussions about creating a GoFundMe. Now, the fiberglass and steel statue originally was a Vulcan on display in the 1988 Winter Carnival in St. Paul. Was that was 88 ice palace year?
I'm not sure on that.
That might have been. That might have been the one they had down on the river. The big one that they did, that might have been. There is a historical element to this. His torso was added by 4 feet and his arms were repositioned to turn into Frankenstein's monster. Who hasn't had that happen? The paper says it was part of a Halloween attraction in the Twin Cities before he bought it. So it's got some history, and especially obviously being associated with the Winter Carnival. Since the arson, people in the community have been placing signs, flowers, and tributes to the Frankenstein statue. Okay. Busy news day in Janesville, Minnesota. So,
can we just agree, anyone who is wearing a blue tarp is not up to any good, given the history of people wearing blue tarps?
Can we go get some of the sneaking music from the Warner Brothers cartoons?
You think the guy was standing behind a tree occasionally trying to...
Oh, gosh, running around with a gas can, pouring gas all over his shoes, leaving his wallet behind. Master criminal at work here. I'm still going to go pound for pound. I'm going to guess. There we go. There it is. Oh, God, it's on my shoes. I got to go over here. There it is. I'm gonna burn them. Oh, I need more matches. Where's my wallet? Damn it. Where's that blue tarp? The blanket's not doing it. It's a hot night. It's, yeah, you're putting a blanket on your head in this seat. It's like, oh, God, it's so hot. I wish I had something to drink. Oh, God, that's the gas. Oh, God. This thing just went wrong every way from
Sunday. If he lit the tarp on fire, though, and was running away with it on, that really looked really cool. A guy in a cape that's burning and on fire.
Yeah, that would have been real cool. We've got
outside of the burn.
Henriette Holdish is going to join us. She's the chief creator for the Walker Arts Center. That comes up in a little bit. I also, though, we've got to get to this interview. Peter Callahan, MinPost, what are you guys going to chat about? I know what you're chatting about.
The filibuster last night. Yeah, yeah. Peter talked about how that – he did not stay up for the entire thing, surprisingly. But we chat about that and then what else they're working on at the state legislature with budgets and what they're doing over the weekend.
Peter Callahan from MinPost joins Brett right now right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. Well, the state legislature is, of course, currently in a special session, and joining us to catch us up on what's happening at the legislature and in the governor's mansion is Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinPost, website minpost.com, for the latest in Minnesota politics, as we're going to be talking about the filibuster that happened last night with Republicans and some other agreements that Republicans and DFLers have reached, at least tentatively, at the legislature. Peter, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Great. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. So let's talk about what happened last night, where a number of budget bills were supposed to be debated and possibly even voted on in the DFL-controlled state house. But that ended up not happening due to, well, I'll call it a filibuster or whatever the technical term might be, but I think it is a filibuster, as Republicans held up these bills for several hours last night. So, Peter, how exactly does this process work? Is this technically a filibuster, or basically just explain kind of the situation last night of how Republicans were trying to at least delay some of these bills?
Sure. In general rules in the House and the Senate as well, there's no limit on floor speeches. That's unusual in state legislatures around the country. I tried to find some state-by-state numbers, and it looks like about 15 states allow unlimited floor speeches. 35 have some caps, you know, minutes or number of times you can speak. So that's somewhat unique in Minnesota that people can talk as long as they want. There's an old saw in legislative politics, which is when you have the votes, you vote. When you don't have the votes, you talk. And in this case, Republicans in the House do not have the votes, so they can do, you know, they can assert power two times. In the bonding bill, which takes a supermajority or a 60% majority to pass, in this case, you need Republican votes to pass a bond bill, and they can control the length of sessions, and they can decide just by talking how long it takes for things to happen. They have made five demands of the Speaker of the House, probably none of which will be met, and in sort of either retaliation or an attempt to, you know, get the Speaker to change her mind, they are blocking passage of these budget bills.
So technically, these could be held up indefinitely if Republicans in the House wanted to, but it sounds like, at least from the DFL side, they don't anticipate that happening, as a lot of them are still saying, no, we're not going to have a shutdown. But Republicans could technically hold these up for a while, as I understand this, or at least indefinitely.
Well, the rules also allow for a motion to call the previous question, which requires a majority vote. And sort of the, I don't want to say gentleman's rule because that's outdated, but the understanding has usually been that you don't do that. You allow floor speeches and amendments to go as long as is required. But at some point, the Speaker will entertain a motion to call the previous question, which has happened a few times by both parties in the past. And if she can get a majority of her members to support that, then debate is ended and a vote is taken on that issue. Now, they haven't even brought up budget bills yet. In both of these cases, yesterday with the Commerce Bill and today with the Agriculture Bill, what they are debating is a motion by Republicans to re-refer the bill back to committee, which is just a technical movement of the bill. That's what's being debated. So they would have to call the previous question, vote on the motion to re-refer, vote it down, bring up the bill, and there are, you know, a dozen or more amendments on each of these budget bills. And each of those would require the same motion if the Speaker decides that the debate is being done to delay. And in this case, the speeches are, of course, being done to delay. They usually have nothing to do with the bills being discussed. We got a very lengthy history of the Civil War today from one of the House Republicans. So at some point, she can invoke that. The Republicans referred to that as the nuclear option, which seems a little exaggerated. And I'm not sure there's a great constituency across the state of Minnesota to allow any member of the House to talk as long as they want. I don't know that that's a deep-seated constitutional right in the minds of most people in the state.
So a few moments ago, you were alluding to some of the objections Republicans had with the bills and some of the demands they have of DFLers that they would like to see changed. Can you walk us through what some of these Republican demands are?
Sure. The one would be the immediate end to the state of emergency, peacetime state of emergency by the governor. One is that all federal money that comes in now and in the future be appropriated by the legislature and not by the governor. Those are two sort of longstanding issues that have go back to the start of the pandemic. A third one is to end the $300 a week top off in unemployment insurance. That's become an issue in other states where there's a theory that the unemployment benefits are too generous and people would rather stay on unemployment than take jobs, and that's contributing to a labor shortage. I will say that will not happen. There's also a very technical issue having to do with corrections to last year's bonding bill. And this is important to some people who have a project in last year's bonding bill because there's some technical thing wrong with the appropriation where they blew through a deadline that was in the bill. And so in order for them to get this bonding money for some local project, some date has to be changed or some technical thing has to be changed. They want that as a separate vote as opposed to being inside the overall bonding bill because that little technical correction, all of those can bring votes into a new bonding bill, and they don't want that necessarily to happen. And they want to reinstate the health care reinsurance program, which is a method for keeping health premiums low, but it's not the DFL's favored method. It is the GOP's favored method. Of those, I'm going to just go out on a limb and say the reinsurance is one possible thing that could flow from that because it isn't strictly a partisan issue, but the others are not going to happen. And it's ironic that the emergency could end on its own by the governor before you could pass bills to end the emergency.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like at least a few of these would certainly be non-starters for the DFL. But as you said, there are a few of those that maybe they could reach an agreement on. But let's talk about these, talk about the emergency powers that you alluded to just a moment ago, because it sounds like at least some Republicans and Democrats are looking at an agreement to have, I guess you would call it an off-ramp to end these emergency powers. Can you describe exactly what they've sort of agreed on in terms of ending the emergency powers?
Sure. Most of the governor's executive orders, which flow from his declaration of a state of emergency, have expired or been rescinded. You know, the ones everyone knows about are the indoor mask mandate, the closures capacity restrictions in bars and restaurants, things like that. Most of the ones that regular and even not so regular Minnesotans were aware of over the last year plus are gone. The eviction ban is sort of the last big one that's left, and there is a bill that we think could be passed the Senate by Monday that is an agreed-upon off-ramp from the eviction moratorium, which what it does, it sort of phases in the authority for landlords to start evicting people, starting with people who have, say, been damaging property or have been, you know, smoking in a non-smoking unit or things like that, sort of non-financial. At the very end would be people who are eligible for help through renthelpmn.org, which has $675 million to push out to help pay back rent for people who are income eligible for that. And they could not be evicted if they're eligible for that program until 1 year from today. So that's that. Once that is gone, there really is only a few things that the governor needs authority to do. He needs authority to continue to do his vaccination and testing program, to acquire and distribute vaccines. That could be done by statute. There's some little technical things about the feds provided extra food stamp benefits for people and a 15% bump up in food stamps. That program is ending at the end of September, so that could be phased out. There really isn't anything left, and there is some talk of coming up with a bill that would let Republicans and maybe some Iron Range DFLers take a vote to end the emergency powers that they could take back to their constituents and say, see, we finally ended the governor's emergency power. The effect is minimal, at least on the ground, but the political effect could be significant enough that they might do that. And you bring that to the floor, I don't think they filibuster that, because the R's would love to vote on that.
And talking about the Republicans, at least political positioning on trying to end Governor Walz's emergency powers, have they shifted their arguments at all recently, being that, as you said, some of these powers are kind of being shifted or being phased out by default? Have they changed their argument in terms of maybe talking about checks and balances instead of just saying it's a raw power grab by the governor?
Yeah, I mean, that's been, you know, as you can't stand there and say, high school sports, mask mandates, restaurant closures, business closures, as those things no longer become resonant with voters and residents, you start talking, and they have started talking about checks and balances, balance of power. The legislature should be an independent branch of government. The governor should not be able to essentially pass legislation on his or maybe someday her own. So that's sort of the issue, as the way they're phrasing the issue. And I think there's less of a constituency out across the state for that. But there are certainly DFL members of the legislature who probably chafe a bit at the idea that they have been so superfluous throughout this. And they do feel like they should have and could have had a bigger role. So there's a possibility that the emergency law, what they often refer to as Chapter 12, could be amended for future emergencies to give the legislature a little more say in the future. As I think everyone agrees, no one envisioned a 15-month state of emergency. When that statute was written, they were thinking of a week after a tornado or something like that. So I think there's some constituency for it, but it's become so politicized that a DFLer is going to be reluctant to appear to be siding with the Republicans against the governor. And as of now, they're sticking to the, you know, lives were saved in allowing the governor to do these things and supporting his actions. But I could say in a year or two or three, there could be a bipartisan constituency for looking at that statute.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if this does continue to be debated at least next year, because as you wrote, I believe, in your piece yesterday for MinnPost, as you talked to some sources within the DFL, it sounds like, well, they think no one's really going to care about this issue, at least with voters in 2022, since for the most part, the emergency will probably be over, and by the time you reach Election Day 2022, Walz will probably have given up his emergency powers for over a year. So that certainly adds an interesting angle to it, too.
Yep. Yep, I don't disagree. I mean, it's hard to know what issues are, but I think all of us can think back at some issue that seemed just the dominant issue of a election, and by the time the election rolls around, people have stopped really thinking about it and caring about it. They have moved on to something new. And if you are not facing the restrictions from an executive order and you haven't for some time, It certainly is not going to be top of mind for a voter. Now, the people who really care about that and are still angry about Governor Walz's actions, they're not voting for him anyway. They will certainly remember, but that's not exactly a constituency that he ever was going to have the opportunity to win back. And he'll still have trouble in greater Minnesota for some of these things. But that is not his base, really, to begin with.
Final one or two questions for you, Peter. So what's going to be happening over the weekend with any negotiations between, I guess you would call, probably the big three parties? That would be Majority Leader in the Senate, Paul Gazelka, House Speaker for the DFL, Melissa Hortman, and, of course, DFL Governor Tim Walz. Are they still doing more negotiations over the weekend? Because as I understand it, there are still a few budget bills that have not necessarily been finalized yet with agreements. So what is the plan, at least over the weekend, for some of the members of the legislature and Governor Walz?
Well, we think that the Senate has adjourned or will shortly adjourn until Monday, so they will not be in formal session over the weekend. We expect that the big three will continue to go through what, you know, they sometimes refer to as the sticking points in bills. We think as of now those are Zoom meetings. They're not in-person meetings. The House, I think the Speaker will force the Senators to keep this up if they want to keep this up and have them miss their Saturday and maybe have them miss their Father's Day before she decides to go to the next step, which is calling the question. So they will be here, I think, all day tomorrow doing what they were doing today and what they were doing yesterday. But it raises the point that there is actually DFL-GOP agreement on most of these issues, and we expect that there will be agreement or the jettisoning of things they can't agree on in a bipartisan manner. This is a Republican DFL agreements that are being reached and have been reached, and the House Republicans are sort of this thing off to the side. If you're just coming in, you might think, oh, there's disagreement between DFL and GOP on these issues. There isn't, at least with those who have the votes to pass these things. So once you get past this procedural blockages, we expect most of these things to pass. And at some point, they will come up with that public safety bill that will come out with some changes on policing and criminal justice before the end of session. Now, they had predicted 7 to 10 days. Well, 7 is Monday, 10 is next Thursday. They would have to get moving pretty quickly and break through the House Republican blockade to finish by next Thursday. But they continue to say they do not expect there to be a government shutdown on July 1.
Yeah, that is the line we continue to hear. But as you say, next week is certainly going to be critical at the legislature to see if we actually do avoid that government shutdown and if some final agreements can be reached. We've been speaking with Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinPost. Website is minpost.com, as we've been talking through what's been happening with the special session over at the state legislature. Peter, really appreciate the time today.
Always fun talking to you, Brett.
Well, no shortage of activity at the state capitol, and I'm sure we'll be reporting more on what's happening next week. Hey, let's take a break and turn things back over to Matt McNeil here on AM 950.
Thanks, Peter Callahan from MinPost, for joining us. Some quick hits here, including the Minnesota coronavirus update. Friday's COVID-19 update from the Department of Health included 115 new cases and, tragically, 4 new deaths. State death toll is now 7,531 since the start of the pandemic. Of the total deaths, most of them in long-term care facilities, the state reported 3,014,795 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 2,799,918 people have completed the vaccine series. So there is that information there. Two little quick hits here. First of all, it sounds like the Senate has adjourned. So even if the Minnesota House does their theatrics of filibustering, nothing is going to get passed this week in regard to the special session of these bills. You know, well, you got when the guy's up in Alaska, for goodness sakes. But they'll only have 9 days left to get every bill passed. And as Melissa Hortman just said, the tax bill is the last one because they know the Republicans want that passed. So they're going to have to get working here. But there's this story. I just want to make sure I mention this. Because remember, Tom Bach and David Tomasoni, the two traitorous DFLers who ran as DFLers, who then left the DFL and jumped and ran and went to the GOP because they said, well, we're tired of both sides. Oh, the heck with you. They showed their true colors. Bach turned heads by attending this week's Minnesota Senate Republican Caucus fundraiser. He's fundraising for the Republicans now. They asked me to come. If the Democrats asked me to come to theirs, I would go. I would absolutely go. If I hadn't been asked, I might not have been there. Oh, sure. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're going to buy your not buy us now. And, of course, former senator as well, and Tomasoni, was also there. So these two clowns, who ran as DFLers, and the second they won their seat, basically became Republicans in independent clothing. They were both there. I think the DFL has to have rules that say if you do this, then you have to pay back every dime you got from the DFL. Bach, an ex-DFL Senate Majority Leader, seven-term Thomas Senator, left the DFL. They align with the GOP. Bach said he's giving PAC's lobbyists a choice of donating to either party fund during his Assembly golf event at first. So, yeah, he's trying to play both sides of it. He's trying to play, and go there. So, yeah, no, I'm not a big fan of that. Bach hasn't said if he's running again for a new term. Some might depend on redistricting, where there's a decent chance in his district and Tomasoni's district will get folded into the same district due to the population shifts. Here's one thing I want to quickly say about that. If these two people actually cared about their own constituents, if they actually cared about the DFLers they're supposedly representing, if they would have stayed with the DFL would have likely tried to keep the two DFL districts separate, and they would have actually still had two DFL districts. But the minute these two opportunist, traitorous jackasses decide to leave the DFL, do you think the Republicans are going to say, oh, two districts that can be a DFL district? No, we'll merge those into one. They lost all power. If the people in their district wonder why did we lose a district on the Iron Range, it's because these two guys, because of personal gain, decided to leave the DFL, which would have tried to preserve those seats, join the Republican Party, who is, I guarantee you, will get rid of at least one of them. That is just a bad idea. And, you know, like I said, the more you see about Bach and Tomasoni, you see the real deal, what they are like. They're in it for themselves. I'd like to see if there was any backroom deals between those guys and the Republicans to get them to leave the DFL, because that's a joke. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. When we come on back, it's going to be a privilege to welcome the chief curator for the Walker Art Center, Henriette. We're going to be joined here by Henriette Holdish is going to join us. We're going to talk about the reopening. A lot of different events going to be coming up at the Walker. We'll get to that in a second. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. I'm going to do some dancing here in a little bit. I'll get to that in just a bit. It is an absolute privilege and an honor to welcome the chief curator and the director of cultural affairs at the Walker Art Center to the show. Henriette Holdish is kind enough to join us. You know she's a good curator. Her first job was at the Whitney. Wow. We are lucky to have her. This is a gem in town. And, of course, the Walker Art Center is a gem. And like a lot of places, they're getting back at it. And I'm so glad to hear that. Henriette, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time today.
Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Now, I want to talk, if I can, really quick about what you just went through with this last year. Here you are, a curator. You're in one of the great museums on the planet, especially when it comes to modern art. You're here. Obviously, your hands were tied. We're dealing with a crisis which is beyond, you know, what you have the capabilities of dealing with. As a curator, though, that's your job. You want to bring the art to the people. That had to be a real tough stretch for you there.
Yes, and, you know, I mean, of course, that is what we do. We make exhibitions, we show performances, we show movies, and we make them for people to see. And that, of course, has been extraordinarily difficult and in some cases impossible for the last year. So it's really, really wonderful to have opened our doors in February, be able to welcome people back. But yes, I mean, you know, we did what we could. We shifted many of our programs online. You know, we experimented with different formats, presented virtual cinema screenings, a number of live dance events that were live streamed. And we did, once we did open the galleries, we, you know, of course, adapted them to COVID protocols and managed capacity and all of the things that we got used to over the last year and now don't have to do anymore.
I got to tell you, and to give you guys kudos over there, because you adapted, you were malleable. What you did, I love the Arrow Awards. We did those online at the beginning of the year. Those were great. And then when you did finally reopen in the safety protocol standards where you had to get the times, you had to get specific times, I can't tell you how wonderful it was to go see the brilliant art you have there because, frankly, because of we were coming out of the winter, it was, you know, and not being able to see great art, it was so wonderful. I'm so glad you guys did. You guys were really proactive, and I think you did a great job in tough conditions to get the people when they could safely into the museum, and I think you did a great job.
Thank you so much. That's really wonderful to hear.
Yeah, you've got, but you're back now. Oh, and we got a lot of things we're going to talk about. You obviously Rock the Garden. They had to make a call on this. A lot of these festivals got moved to fall, and that's really not an option there. But for pretty much everything else, you guys are bringing back everything. A lot of this stuff is some of it's open, some of it's going to be opening. Let's run through the things the Walker's starting with, including one of the most popular things that's been going over there: the mini golf. The Skyline Mini Golf is back, and you've actually got some newly designed holes there. Correct.
We do. It is back, and I know people missed it last summer. We have a total of 10 holes, and there are two new ones, like you said, and they were, which has been an absolute pleasure, designed in collaboration with the Native Youth Arts Collective, which is a paid arts program for high school students in Minneapolis. And members from that group designed two different holes. They're called Turtle Pond, and the other one is called Dream Catcher. And, you know, from that, you can glean a little bit what the shapes and the animals is that inspired that. So those are part of that 10-hole course that you can do on our terraces with a really spectacular view of the downtown skyline.
And it is. It's one of the best views you're going to find of the downtown down there. And as a matter of fact, it kind of overwhelms you how nice it is there. Is that open now?
It is. It's right. Open.
And for people to get it, it's $10 to do it. It's worth it. By the way, get the membership. I'm going to say this a lot here, Henrietta. Go get the membership. The membership of the Walker is so worth it. You're going to get so much value out of that. Get the membership, but there is an admission cost, $8 for Walker members, and you need to purchase tickets at the main lobby desk if they want to go do that, correct?
That's correct. You do a better promotion for the membership than I could. Thank you. But yes, it's $8 for members, $10 for the general public. And it is popular. So yes, do reserve your tickets or show up and buy it at the desk.
I'm not sure if you're aware of this. I'm a huge fan of that museum. I love that museum so much. So I'm a big advocate for you guys, and I always will be. You've got an artist in residence going to be coming on in here, and it sounds like it's going to be in the community garden. Talk a little bit about what's opening up on July 10th.
This is a project that we've actually been working on. Our education department, the Department of Public Education, Impact and Learning, has been working with Des Moines-based artists Jordan Weber for 2 years. This has been a really intensive program in which Jordan collaborated with a local organization called Youth Farm with many, many community members and residents to design an urban farm and community garden on Lindale Avenue between 23rd and 24th Street in North Minneapolis. So over the course of this year, he has designed a garden that will produce produce as well as pollution mitigating plants. The design is based on the shape of an urban basketball court. So you have two rain catchers that kind of look like basketball hoops. It's a really, you know, visually kind of amazing space, as well as a community garden that will be producing food for local residents and will also be providing a space to gather, to meet, and to rest on this particular site. So that opens with a big community celebration on July 10th from 11 to 1. Some activities, some speeches, of course. The artist will be there, his collaborators will be there, and we're also having a pop-up farmers market with local vendors, so it'll be really, really fun
as
to celebrate the opening of that project that has been so long in the making.
As a curator, because that's fascinating, because what you're doing is you're taking art and you're moving it into realms which generally are not associated with art in pollution mitigation, affordable food, and healthy food options. It really is a kind of an amazing concept of trying to do this. When they kind of propose this to you, I mean, when you started to wrap your as a curator, your head about all the impacts of what this, you know, one piece would be kind of doing here, it must have been exciting, especially when you look at how especially the younger generation right now, how active they have been as far as making sure social issues are so important.
Right. I mean, I think that's what made this this project and then the artist Jordan Weber so compelling. he is, I mean, he is an artist who is an activist as well as an artist. There are many, there are others like that, whose work really is specifically geared at engaging communities and dealing with issues of justice, of environmental justice, of social justice. So he is part of a generation of younger artists whose work really critically is located not only inside the museum, but goes out into other spaces and engages communities directly.
It sounds fascinating. I'm definitely going to have to get up there and see that, because I do love when we start getting into that point where it all merges together into something that a community can be really proud of, not only of a practical purpose, not only of a long-range idea purpose, but also just that, as you said, that immediate, beautiful design that does look like a basketball court. I've seen the images so far, and how you can kind of create something new and beautiful as people can enjoy it for the art that it is itself.
Exactly. I mean, you really, like you're saying, you can really experience it as a piece of environmental art, like a piece of land art, but it's also a functioning garden, and that's what makes it really so meaningful.
You have another exhibit going to be opening up. I think it actually is already opened, just opened here, from was it Rayanne Tabbitt? This is a Beirut-based artist. She has got a new an exhibit there, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Rayanne Tabbitt. And his show did open just a week ago. It's brand new. It's a solo exhibition. Really interesting, very researched-based project, which took its point of departure actually from Rayanne's visit to the IBM facility in Rochester, Minnesota, which is a kind of very stunning modernist building designed by the Finnish architect Eero Saarinen. And kind of from there, he really delved into the architectural history and made a connection to Edward Larrabee Barnes, who designed the Walker Building and made an exhibition that is quite architectural. He has designed a two-colored blue film that covers our large windows in what is called Cargo Lounge, which is a public space that looks out into our upper garden, and you might be familiar with, and kind of transforms that whole lobby into a space bathed in blue light. And those are the colors of the IBM corporate spectrum, so he kind of makes that connection. And then his exhibition continues in a gallery space where he has used chairs from that have been decommissioned from the facility, designer chairs that are kind of mounted sort of like a cinema auditorium formation from the ceiling and forming this kind of spectral, ghostly cinema space. It's a really interesting show and definitely worth checking out.
I'm fascinated because I know which room you're talking about. I didn't realize it was that room. I'm going to go check that one out for sure. And then also the exhibit Paradox of Stillness. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, this is an exhibition that was our show that was supposed to have opened in April of 2020. Of course, that didn't happen, so it was postponed for a year. It is a group show of about 60 artists that has been long, long in the making. The curator, my colleague Vincenzo De Bellis, has been thinking about this for over a decade, that thinks about stillness, both in performance and in the object. And really the sort of central premise of that exhibition, and which makes it really unique as an experience, is that you'll come into the galleries and you'll see paintings and sculptures, quote, more or less traditional objects, but you also have live performers in the gallery spaces at any given time. In certain cases, they're part of another work that is also a sculpture. For example, there's one work by the artist Felix Gonzalez Torres, which is a go-go dancer pedestal, which at certain times in the exhibition actually has a dancer on it performing. And so there are other instances like that, kind of really thinking about what it means to depict motion in a painting, something that is a still object, but then also what it might mean to think about a performer or a body kind of as a living or more or less still sculpture.
And once again, you know, one thing I love about the Walker, pushing that limits, because it's, you know, there are a lot of great museums that just have traditional sculptures and stuff, but the idea of exploring not only a traditional sculpture, but also how humans can interact in it. I've been enjoying that. That's kind of, I'm seeing that more as a trend right now. And I'm glad this exhibit finally happened, because I know that was tough to have to cancel that one last year.
And I mean, as you can imagine, thinking about an exhibition that requires ongoing performance in the gallery space has probably been the hardest one you could possibly do in reopening the museum. So this went through many, many permutations of figuring out how the performers were going to be positioned, how we'd be managing, you know, visitors working through. But in spite of all of those challenges, it came together just beautifully, and it works really well. And I think maybe especially because of this experience over the last year of not having been with people other than the ones in our houses, kind of makes it particularly resonant to be next to these works of art, but then also performers that are right alongside them.
If you need me to go dance, just let me know. I can be over there. I know I don't do it too often, but for you, in a heartbeat.
I think the auditions are closed okay. for that, but we'll keep you in mind.
All right. Also, I do want to mention we're going to put the calendar up as well. There are so many, and as a matter of fact, the calendar will have all this listed on it that I want people to go over. And of course, I'll do the same pitch I gave before. I'm a member of the Walker. It is worth every dollar tenfold. It is a magnificent membership. Get the membership. Support the museums. Support all the museums, because once again, tough year last year. They're coming back, and they got a lot to offer. Henriette, this is an absolute privilege. I thank you so much for the time today, and all my best. I hope this summer is very, very busy for you.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having us and me, and hopefully see you at the Walker sometime.
I'll keep an eye out for you. Thank you very much. Henriette Haldish is joining us once again, Chief Curator for the Walker Art Center. Let's take a break. Come on back. We'll wrap up the show when we come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, and like I said, it's not just the Walker. A lot of them are opening up again. Get back out to the museums. Get to the zoos. Try to enjoy the world. Try to get in the zoo and the other places to get before they get shut down by the Republicans trying to lock down the state. So, all right. So, you know, here's the deal. For many, during the pandemic, we'd do dancing on Friday. We'd do dancing a lot of days, actually, because we were going through a tough time. Well, and then I went through a relatively serious health crisis. Didn't expect that. And it got to a point, especially around the time of the Chauvin trial, that it just didn't seem appropriate. So we've kind of stopped it, but it's summer. Hit it! We got it? Wilson Pickett? Indeed. Indeed. Land of 1,000 dances, folks. We're dancing this one out today. You have a good weekend. We're back on a Monday. Till then, see ya!
Say it one time. Nah, nah.